Hello and welcome to House to Astonish episode 64. I'm Paul O'Brien.
And I'm Al Kennedy. And in the week when in Britain the media and politicians have been accused of being far too cosy with each other, we ask, just how did J. Jonah Jameson get to be mayor of New York? Later on, we're going to be looking at All Nighter by David Hahn, Red Wing by John Hickman and Nick Patara, and X-Men Schism by Jason Aaron and Carlos Pacheco. But first, a little bit of the comics news from the last couple of weeks. Well, first off, there's the DC solicitations have started coming out.
This is for October, the second month. Now, we're not going to go through the full solicitations. No. That'll be in the next podcast.
Actually,
next time.
Do you reckon? Next one will be our San Diego wrap-up. Will we have time to do solicitations and a San Diego wrap-up?
Well, probably, because nothing's ever announced at San Diego, other than look out for some announcements about films.
Well, we'll see.
You know, it's not a comics convention. It's not.
We'll see. Well, apparently...
It's a place where people from comics get together and then learn about films.
Apparently there's a new Defenders book coming by the looks of those teasers that have been put out.
Well, but I don't know how we'll find room to cover the solicitations in addition to the announcement of a Defenders comic.
It's got Iron Fist in it. I could talk about that for a while.
Okay, so this is the early solicitations for DC for October. Mm. So issue 2 of the big relaunch. And surprise, surprise, there's already some fill-in creators showing up, most notably on David Fincher's Batman comic, which seems to have an entire fill-in co-creative team on issue number 2. Now, this is a series that was already more or less pushed back 4 months, so...
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, this issue is based on a suggestion by David Finch. It's so it seems, anyway.
Based on a phone call with David Finch. Look for Stan Lee, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you reckon that the plots are going to be a bit like that? Paul Jenkins or whoever it is that's writing it. Is it Paul Jenkins?
Paul Cornell, isn't it?
Oh, somebody.
World of difference.
Who, one of these Pauls. You all look the same, you Pauls. Getting just a bit of paper telegraphed to him that just says, Paul, make it about the Joker this month. Thanks. Lots of love, David.
Could Batman be in it? Yeah, I mean, okay, books are going to run late from time to time. If you have 52 books, I'm sure one of them, somebody's going to fall ill or something of that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not the end of the world. But the point is that it plays into this whole idea of just how far in advance did DC really plan this? How much have they thought this through? Mm-hmm. If you're going to do something this big, you'd think you'd want to plan it in advance, but there are all these signs that suggest that once you get beyond the top tier of books, they may not have planned it that far in advance.
Yeah, but there's all that chat, wasn't there, about how DC were insisting that 3 issues of each series were in the can, ready to go, before they actually launched any of them.
Well, apparently one reason for that is that they're trying to sell these day and date on iTunes.
Yeah, and you need to do the digital preparation on all these things.
Exactly, and iTunes is a lot less flexible about its deadlines than printers might be, or Diamond might be. So
it's almost as if one of these other industries has some kind of standards that you might have to live up to.
Or choice. Mm. That if you're Apple, you maybe have better things to do than bend over backwards for what Marvel and DC want.
Yeah, waiting for... Issue 2 of David Finch's Batman book.
But we digress. Mm. It's just another sign that they may not be quite as prepared for this as you might hope. And that is a worrying sign. But
yeah, I mean, to be fair though, you could honestly have guessed this was coming with David Finch. It's not like David Finch has been a guy who has ever really been known for getting his own stuff out in that timely a fashion.
Sure, but it's not the only one. There are a couple of others floating around as well. I forget which. I think Roger Robinson's disappeared.
He got taken off the book. I don't know why.
Yeah. You would like to think that something this important, they'd at least have it properly planned for the first few months, just to give people enough lead-in time. But and if they're not doing that, is it all going to go horribly wrong? It's DC, it's a relaunch. Of course it's all going to go horribly wrong. It always does.
I mean, if they're taking Roger Robinson off of Mr. Terrific, and on the basis that we are working on a system where DC comics are being done by people whose first names are set but surnames are interchangeable, they should get Roger Hargreaves to do Mr. Terrific.
Isn't he dead?
He is dead, but they're still bringing books out with his name on it.
That's true. And that same goes for Kirby.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, see, the thing is, the sad thing is that you may have better luck getting a timely book out of a dead British children's book writer than you would out of David Finch. But no, I can just imagine Mr. Terrific. He would now be sort of blue and square, maybe, with a little bowler hat, tiny bowler hat on the top of his head.
Somewhat more important news. Marvel have launched what they are calling a New Stores initiative. Basically, this is an attempt by Marvel to provide financial support for people who want to open a new comic mm-hmm. book store. People who hate money, for example. Mm-hmm. People who are enticed by the prospect of bankruptcy. If you are such a person, then yeah. you might want to open a comic book store in 2011 in a harsh market and a difficult time.
There's a couple in southwest Scotland who've just come into £161 million. They might want to find somewhere where they can set fire to huge stacks of cash.
Now, in fairness, Marvel fully understand that it's a difficult business setting up a new comic store. And there's also a great awareness among Marvel and DC that since they're dependent on bricks and mortar stores for the foreseeable future, it would be quite nice if there were more of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, persuading people to open new stores is difficult. It's risky at the best of times. It's a down market. And it's a down market where everyone is saying, oh, it's all going to be shut in 5 years anyway. With the way people talk, you'd be a bold and dedicated person who wanted to open a comic book store. So what Marvel are offering is massive discounts on Marvel supplies for the first few months.
Yeah, it's a 53% discount for 6 months. I don't know how different that is from the standard discount that retailers get, but they're also giving 59% discount on a one-time stocking of items.
So order all your back catalogue, I guess.
Yeah, to get your shop ready to go, to fill it up before you open, they'll give you this nearly 60% discount. They give you free copies of Knocking On for 24 trades. They'll give you free variant editions. You get exclusive calls with Marvel and Diamond sales guys. You get free access to the Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that you get given. An interesting thing as well is that it also applies to if you already have a comic book store and are looking to open another branch of it, then you can still, that store can qualify. Your existing store can't, but your new store can qualify for all this stuff. So it helps people not only to set up new stores but to expand existing, which is good.
I mean, Marvel are not known for bending over backwards to assist retailers. Their usual strategy has tended to be that retailers don't have any choice, so they'll just have to lump it. But this time Marvel do seem to be genuinely trying to do something to help them. They want more bricks and mortar stores there. They're putting something behind it. Maybe some people take them up on the offer.
Interesting that DC are going much further down the digital route than Marvel are willing to go. And Marvel seem to be throwing a lot of their weight behind traditional brick and mortar stores. Whether that is indicative of the way that the companies each think, or whether it's just something where Marvel are saying, well, we've seen that DC are going down this route. They've been going down that route for a long time. They've been really, really pushing their Comixology involvement and so on. We don't think that the direct market is quite as ready to be written off yet as DC may do. We're going to throw our weight behind them. Although it could just be the fact that, as we've said last time around, DC really seems to be looking long-term on the digital side of things, as opposed to Marvel really don't seem to be doing that.
I think that's right. I think DC don't want to move to digital in the immediate future either. They're just trying to lay the groundwork mm-hmm. for that. But it does beg a question. If everyone's sending the message that the conventional comic store is dying, then that leaves you with a very fragile retailer base and mm-hmm. forces everyone into a position of having to migrate to digital to escape the coming day where the number of comic stores dwindles to nothing. I mean, it's already a fraction of what it was at the peak of the market in the mid-90s.
Yeah, it's about a tenth or something like that of the number that it was back then. I seem to remember reading. That's obviously a wild guesstimate there.
But to be fair, some of those missing stores, the sales will have consolidated into the ones that remain. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, books that are now doing 30,000 weren't selling, their equivalents weren't selling 300,000 back in the day.
No, but they were selling 100,000.
No, you know, that's
there, sure. There was a story that there was huge day of thunderclouds over everybody's head in Marvel when figures came in for the launch of the third Punisher book and it had only sold 1 million copies. You know, this kind of thing. We're in a completely different market now than we were, obviously. I mean, no one listening to this really is under any illusions that we're in the same comics market that we were in 20 years ago. But at the same time, are we quite ready yet to be writing off the direct market? I don't think
we
are. Marvel certainly don't seem to think that they are.
Even DC don't think
DC
we are.
Don't, but DC seem to be making much more in the way of overtures towards the digital market. You know, it now is, you know, it was previously thought of that, you know, Marvel was the bad boyfriend to the direct market, and DC was the dependable one that was always there for them whenever Marvel treated them badly. Now DC's the one that's two-timing on them with the digital market, and Marvel is like, oh, here, we'll buy you nice things.
DC still expect to be on board with bricks and mortar stores for the foreseeable future, but they are building a lifeboat.
Definitely. Talking of digital things, Diamond Digital is launching in September. This is this thing we've talked about before where retailers will get codes which can be given to their customers. Now, the customers, if they then use those codes, the use of that code will, because it's generated uniquely for the store, it will mean that the store will be credited with 33% of the cost of the book.
Right. Why would I want to buy my comic by going into a bricks and mortar store and buying a code over the counter, which I would then go home and insert into my computer / iPad / whatever, instead of just buying it off Comixology?
Well,
what's the advantage to me as a customer?
Well, firstly, because it's not, it isn't Comixology, as it for a start. It's a completely separate thing.
But let's assume that I can get this stuff on Comixology.
If you can get that stuff on Comixology, then fair enough, you might want to just sit at home and read it at home, buy it at home. But I don't think it's designed to be an alternative to you going into the store. It's supposed to be a thing where if you've come into the store to buy Wolverine and Captain America books, and you come up and you're chatting away to the guy at the counter, and the guy at the counter says, oh, we got our codes in this week. There's a really good book out from Top Shelf that I think you might like. It's you like funny books. There's a really funny book that's just been put out by Top Shelf. Take this code, see what you think. Yeah, great. Okay, you get it in your bag and you go home and you might try that out.
So it's supposed to be a promotional device?
It's partly a promotional device, but you do have to pay for the comics individually, and you know that's how the stores would make money off it. They're launching it as a basically a big conglomerate of publishers, about 30-odd publishers, including IDW, Image, Top Shelf, Archie, and Papercuts. But there are, you know, there's an awful lot of publishers involved, including some very, very small ones. And Comixology's got a lot of very small publishers as well. And I don't know what the crossover is between these two, but apparently it's launching with 2,000 back issues in place.
My concern about this is I think it's trying to solve a problem which the consumer doesn't actually have in the first place. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is find a way in which bricks and mortar retailers can benefit from sending people to buy digitally.
Yes, if you're going to be buying comics digitally, you might as well be giving us some money while you're doing it.
Which is the equivalent of record stores giving out codes from which you can go and download something off iTunes. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why that's an appealing model for the customer. It seems to me like an attempt to take something the customer might want, assuming he's interested in digital comics at all, and then trying desperately to shoehorn it into a retailer-shaped hole. I don't get it. I don't understand why this is appealing.
I think that is, you know, not an unfair comparison, but at the same time, it would be if a record shop was giving you a code for something you could download off of iTunes, but that was the only way that you could download it off of iTunes. You couldn't just go and buy it off of iTunes if you were just sitting in your house without the code. You know, I'm sure that there will be a crossover between the things that you can buy on Comixology and the things that you can buy from Diamond Digital. But firstly, we don't know what the pricing is for Diamond Digital. It may well be that it's cheaper to buy it on Diamond Digital. That would be an interesting way to go, particularly if these publishers were wanting to try to keep bricks and mortar stores sweet slightly. You know, what if you have to go and buy a comic that's, you know, $2.99 on Comixology, but it costs you $2.50 if you buy it through Diamond Digital?
I suppose I can see the logic from the point of view of you're interested in buying, say, an indie book, mm-hmm. which most retailers wouldn't have bothered to order because they think it's going to be dead stock. Mm-hmm. With this, the retailer presumably doesn't have to order anything or commit any money in advance.
They don't pay a thing for it. They get enrolled in the program. They get, what they do is they log on to the website, put together their pull list, and then the codes are generated on the basis of what books do I want to stock codes for.
But hold on, What's the point in limiting the retailer to being able to sell a certain number of copies? Why not just have a situation where the customer goes to the desk and says, I'd like to buy acclaimed indie comic Z, please, and the retailer then generates a code online and gives it to you, thus making sure that in the unlikely event that the retailer actually has more people who want to buy the comic than he originally anticipated, he can still sell it.
I don't think there's any indication that they're going to limit the number of codes. You just, there's all it says is that you can go online, figure out which ones you want, and then print that off. I don't think it then says that you then
can
can't do it again.
As you want.
I would hope that you wouldn't be limited. It'd be a bit slightly crazy. Yes. Well, that's how Dark Horse's one is working, where it's the 100 codes per store for the 8-page exclusive tie-ins to their big titles.
But to be fair, that's a hype thing. That's not something which is being predominantly used as a product in its own right.
Mm-hmm. And I believe those Dark Horse ones are free as well, the little 8-pagers.
This feels like an attempt to somehow link the digital product with a bricks-and-mortar store in a way that just doesn't make sense. It just seems like an incredibly cumbersome way to buy a digital product. And I don't think I don't think customers will want it unless they're forced and have no alternative.
There's a thing where you can find out all the details of it, but you do have to, like, all the details of it, but you do have to be a retailer with a Diamond login already, at which point, you know, you would then find out what the ins and outs of it are. If you're a retailer who doesn't want to take part in it, who doesn't think it makes sense for them, then you don't need to take part in it. It's essentially extra money for them. There's no downside
that's
to taking
true.
Part in this.
I understand from why it might be appealing to a retailer. I just don't understand why it would be appealing to a consumer.
I don't know, if you went into a comic shop, I mean, we don't, you know, we get our books mail order now, but if you were to go into a comic shop and you were buying, say, any of these books that we've got in front of us, if you're buying Red Wing, say, and they said, oh, we've got a download. Have you tried Nightly News by Jonathan Hickman? It's, you know, it's pretty good. We'll just pop a code for that in your bag for you. You wouldn't say, well, fie and away with you and your code.
Well, I might have. They said, and that'll be $3.99, please.
No, but that's the thing, is that you don't charge for the code. You take the code home. You don't pay the retailer for that code. You take it home, and if you decide that you want to cash in that code, and that's your choice, then at that point, when the money goes from you to Diamond Digital, the retailer gets credited with a cut of it.
Okay, yes. I might take the code. Am I going to use it? Maybe, I suppose.
If you do, then that's great for you, you know, you get a comic. If you don't, then again, it's no skin off your nose, and there's no point in not.
It just seems like an incredibly roundabout way of doing things.
It's very convoluted. It does involve you traipsing to a comic shop in order to get something when you get back home.
Yeah. No, I don't think this is going to work, but at least they're trying to square the circle.
And fair play to them for trying to come up with something.
Yep.
Because this is their business that they're seeing disappearing. You know, Diamond are not in the business of... you know, Diamond are not Comixology. Diamond are not the ones who are making comics, like Marvel and DC or whatever, are selling comics through their apps. And that money's not going to Diamond. It's maybe going partly to Apple or partly to Comixology, but it's not going to Diamond. So Diamond are having to do something to try and retain... You know, if the direct market goes away, then a comics distributor has no place.
What a shame.
And speaking of things which have no place in the digital world, this has been a very good podcast for segues. This is working very well. The Zurich Grant is wrapping up. Zurich Grant, founded 20 years ago by Peter Laird, creator of Ninja Turtles. And it was a biannual grant for indie comics and self-published comics.
Basically to fund... cartoonists to make their first self-published work.
Yep.
Or early self-published work, at least.
Yeah, and you know, there have been people like Jason Lutz and Linda Medley, and, you know, comics like Jar of Fools and Castle Waiting for those two. And, like, Action Philosophers, for example, won a Zurich Grant in 2004.
It's certainly funded some excellent work, no doubt about that. So why is it wrapping up?
It's wrapping up because, Laird says that essentially in... a world where Kickstarter exists and where you can basically publish your comics for minimal money on the internet.
Barriers to entry are so low that there's better things they can do with the money.
Exactly. Indie comics creators don't need the Xeric grant so much anymore. The thing about
that's the point, because the Xeric grants, nobody was making money off Xeric grants. Mm. The Xeric grants were covering the costs of getting your book printed and distributed and so forth. And of course, if all you want to do is distribute your book to a mass to a wide audience at break even, you can stick it on the web.
Yeah, exactly. And if you want to, you know, have a huge print run of hardcover books or whatever, then you can set an ambitious target as a Kickstarter project. The thing is, though, that the Xeric grant, you know, being a Xeric Award winner, got you into comic book shops. You know, if
does
you
it
had,
still?
If well, if you had the, you know, you still see that Xeric X in the corner of books, you know, Xeric Award winner 2000 and whatever, and it still gets you into comic book shops. But I think it was Brian Hibbs was saying on the comments thread on this on the Beat that you know, he's taken every single Xeric recipient that he's been offered. But he would not dream of taking every single Kickstarter project that appeared online, because there is a quality control procedure in place for the Xeric grant, in that somebody has seen the comic and decides that they wanted to help fund that. For a Kickstarter project, what you've seen is a concept. You might have seen some art, but you haven't seen the comic.
That's a good point, but that's the advantage which Xeric had, not for giving out the money, but just from acting as a critic, as a trusted critic.
Yeah, exactly, because you knew when you saw that Xeric X on the front, probably it was going to be a good book.
And yeah, can you not still achieve the same sort of publicity by distributing your book to, well, who would you send it to? Comics Journal?
Yeah.
Warren Ellis?
People online, yeah, I mean, online word of mouth is, I think, something which sells a lot of comics. It builds a lot of good word around comics.
You stick your thing online and build it that way. And
exactly.
You don't necessarily need to get it stocked. If your initial aim is simply to get your work out there and break even, then you don't necessarily need to get it stocked.
Yeah, and it's, you know, people, if you have got some art up on your blog, if you're showing that you're producing pages and so on, then there's every possibility that, you know, you might end up publishing through Image or somebody like that.
Exactly. There's a lot of stuff you see listed in previews, which is, you know, collected edition of the successful online strip. I mean, Image put out a collection of Emmytown,
which is a sketch diary.
It's very good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's not something which even obviously lends itself to the collection format. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's a great example of how you do it. You put something online, you get a following. And once you've got a following, you parlay that into access to the stores.
Yep. So that is the news from the last couple of weeks. We'll obviously have a great big roundup of stuff next time round, but we're going to be moving on to doing a few comic books, because that's our thing, you know.
It's mainly the subject of the podcast.
Yeah, it's the point.
Right. What should we start with?
Left to right, or start with the one that you've got at the top of your pile?
Let's start with All Nighter.
Cool. Okay. All Nighter by David Hahn, written by, drawn by
David Hahn.
David Hahn. The dude did it all himself. Now, you know the story behind this, whereas I don't really.
Well, I read this first as something I ordered out of previews, and read it and thought, oh, that's kind of like if you're indie cinema type thing. Mm-hmm. And then I Googled it to double check some of the other stuff David Hahn had done and make sure I was thinking of the right creator. And yeah, it turns out this is an abandoned project from the Minx imprint, which has been adapted into a miniseries. I gather the adaptation mainly consists of adding a few pages here and there to make sure that the double page spreads sit correctly in the serial form. So it's not been drastically changed by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So what we have here is a Minx Digest, which has been broken down into a five-issue miniseries.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see that, definitely.
It's very much
a Minx project.
The moment somebody says to you, it's a Minx book, you go, oh yes.
Yeah, of course it is.
Of course it's a Minx book.
Like the Minx, all the other Minx books, it's a black and white, it's a non-genre comic, but I suppose it has a genre in the same way that, you know, films that are like this have a genre, which is its, you know, it's the kind of thing that you expect to see turning up at the Edinburgh Film Festival.
It is absolutely the sort of thing you expect to see turning up at the Edinburgh Film Festival. It vaguely reminded me of the film Late Night Shopping, actually.
Yeah, it'll have four showings at the Film House over a period of a few days, and they'll all be on in the afternoon.
Which is a good thing.
No, exactly. But this is the kind of thing that this is. It's interesting that this is coming out through Image, because really, in a way, looking at it, it's also almost a prototypical Oni book, really.
Well, Minx basically was an exercise in selling Oni comics to teenagers.
Mm, but I'm just interested that it's not coming out through Oni.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually.
I mean, obviously, it was...
I'm trying to remember who published David Hahn's earlier self-published, not self, but creator-owned book, mm-hmm. Private Beach. I think that was Slave Labour.
Oh, I can't remember.
I think it was SLP.
I've heard of it, but I haven't actually read it.
It's quite good. It looks nothing like this. Mm-hmm. I've got it. Private Beach is much more curvy. None of this sort of really angular, minimal stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a complete change of style since that, although, you know, many years have passed.
In terms of his art style...
We should explain the concept.
Oh, yeah. The concept is it's about a girl called Kat who lives with her mate Sally and this other girl who she doesn't like very much. And she's got a loser on-off boyfriend called Dwayne who wants to get her involved in an obviously ill-fated criminal activity, which he wants to pursue.
It would be an unusual story if it turned out to be a completely well-fated criminal activity.
They do their crim thing and it all goes fine. The end. Crime pays. That'd be a good
crime
comic.
Pays would be
crime
a great comic.
Pays.
Every strip ends with a panel of a drug lord sitting next to a swimming pool with his thumbs up and a big smile.
I think it's the new imprint of biographies from Blue Water. It's just people who committed crimes and apparently got away with them.
Successful crimes, the new imprint.
Crime Pays featuring Rebecca Brooks.
Sub judice.
Well, yeah, so they hang out at this diner, which is called the All-Nighter, or they call the All-Nighter. And apart from that, there's not a whole heck of a lot of plot to it. It's very much a character-driven piece rather than a plot-driven piece, certainly in these early pages, anyway.
There's also a subplot about another girl coming to live with them, mm-hmm. which doesn't really get very far into in this first issue, but it's there. Yeah. I do kind of get the sense that it's been arbitrarily cut off where the end of the first issue happens to fall. Mm-hmm. It's not... I mean, it kind of times nicely enough as a cliffhanger, but you suspect when you know it started life as a digest that it's actually just been stopped mid-scene.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's, you know, as a book, it's got an awful lot to recommend it. Hahn's art in particular, I think, is really good. The influences are all over the place in terms of who you can see in this art, because there's some Colleen Coover in there, there's some Jamie Hewlett in there, some Woodrow Phoenix, there's a little bit of Steve Rolson, there's even a little bit of Jim Mahfood in there occasionally.
Great character artist.
And some Genndy Tartakovsky as well. But he is very good at getting across expression without using a lot of detailed facial expression stuff. He's not a Kevin Maguire style artist who's doing every facial muscle movement.
No, exactly. He's
much sparser.
He's a great cartoonist. He knows his characters can act, which is... when you see an artist who can really do that, it really does stand out from the crowd.
Mm-hmm. But the art is, I think, the main selling point. The story, I think, is a little slim.
Yeah.
Just in this first issue. I think it's because it's, you know, the first part of a five-part story, which is not paced for five issues. It's paced for a digest.
I think you're right. And if it was a plot-driven book, that would be more of a problem for mm-hmm. me. But since it's basically an introduction to the character... and it does introduce the character, and there is a fair amount of incident there, at least. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay. I think it gets away with it.
Yeah, and the characters are all very well delineated and are entertaining to read about. And given that that is the kind of comic that it is, it's difficult to fault it on that basis, because it's not like it's not like it's Schism. You know, you're not picking it up expecting to see something happen in it, and then nothing happens in it. You know, it's
that's
not
fairly
like,
disgusting.
I think they should probably just have published something before that, Prelude to Schism, where it's just a photo story of Nick Lowe briefing you about the fact that you probably shouldn't be reading Prelude to Schism, because it's a more of a thematic than a story link, whatever that means. Anyway, we'll get on to Schism later on. With this comic, though, it's not a story that is, so far at least, being driven along by the events. It's a story which is being driven along by the character.
Something which occurred to me, actually, as we were just talking now. Why is this a miniseries? Minx presumably have already paid for this.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it a miniseries? Why isn't he just putting it out as a digest?
I don't know. It's not like Image don't put out OGNs.
Yeah.
I really don't know, actually. It's interesting. I wonder if it's just to kind of amortise the cost over 5 months. But
why, when it's already been paid for?
Well, it's been paid for by Minx, but given that Minx aren't publishing it, I would imagine they probably want that money back.
I guess.
If you're going to go off and publish your comic through another company, I don't think Minx want to be subsidising that, really.
Well, it's been long enough since Minx went under that I wonder whether the rights just reverted to him after a while.
Well, when did... Minx has only been gone for how long? 18 months?
Which could be long enough for the rights to revert. If they've done nothing with it.
From DC, under a contract that's been drafted by lawyers employed by Warner Brothers. I imagine Hans probably had to buy this back.
In that case, yeah, I suppose he could be spreading the cost over 5 issues.
Yeah, and, you know, why would... You know, do you make more money publishing an OGN than you do publishing a 5-issue mini? Does it cost you more?
It certainly costs more up front. It's a mm-hmm. cash flow issue, I mm-hmm. think, is the issue about going for single issues rather than trades.
There we go. That's completely
baseless speculation there.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so I actually think this is a really enjoyable comic.
I really liked it.
The fact that the comic stops before the plot really gets motoring is a little bit annoying, slightly off-putting, but I think, ironically, it will read very well as a collected edition, because that's clearly what it was meant to be.
And even in the first issue, it does such a good job of setting up the characters that it still makes you want to come back for the second issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, pretty good there. Next, do you want to do Schism?
Let's do Schism. X-Men Schism, issue 1 of 5. This is a miniseries that leads into the relaunch of the two X-Men titles.
Yes.
Uncanny X-Men is going to be relaunched as Uncanny X-Men. Just complicated
that. They shook that one up a lot there.
And something called Wolverine and the X-Men is going to be created, whether it's replacing an existing title or a completely new title, which would give us 5 monthly X-Men titles.
Have you seen the interview, the Talking All Things X-Men interview that went up on, I think it was Newsrama or possibly CBR, where they were going through all the X-books and saying, what is the place of this X-book, that X-book, the other X-book? Sort of in a post-Schism landscape.
It's Newsarama.
Was it New? I think.
I don't know. I haven't read it.
And it was either Newsarama or CBR, one of the big sites. And they went through all the books, and they were asked, "You know, what about Astonishing X-Men? What's its place in all this?" And they said, "Well, Astonishing X-Men is where you go to read stories that are not necessarily tied down to the continuity. If you just want to read one X-Men book, then Astonishing will not be tied into all this other stuff going on." The one glaring omission from that interview was they did not mention X-Men, adjectiveless.
Right.
So I presume that's the one that will be metamorphosing into Wolverine the X-Men.
So they're relaunching
place
that.
In the schedule.
They're relaunching that about 15 months into its run. Wow, that's dumb.
Well, not so much even relaunching, I guess, replacing, because it's not like...
It's the same thing.
Well, it's not like... it's not the same book, though, is it? They're taking off a redundant X-Men title and they're replacing it with a title that's tied into the... well, it's essentially a second flagship title, a second A title.
And
I don't know how that's going to work.
And to be fair, it worked with Uncanny and X-Men back in the 90s when they were equals. If you're going to have... Yeah, they were.
X-Men was the A title, surely. Chris Claremont and Jim Lee were on X-Men.
For 3 issues.
Yeah.
But after fairly early stage, it settled into the plots jumping back and forth between them. There's a long stretch in the late 90s where basically it's just one title fortnightly and there's some permanent crossover. So yeah, they can be done as equals. What they seem to be doing here is setting up two separate X-Men teams. And certainly, if you're going to have multiple X-Men titles, I'd prefer them to have distinct casts, and that's one way of doing it. This could be a roundabout way of just getting us to having West Coast X-Men essentially.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised actually if that happened. If
some of them
Scott
stay in California,
on Utopia, and Wolverine went back to the mansion, maybe.
There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that.
No.
I think that's it's a way of giving the books their own identity.
Mm-hmm. And particularly if you had then a division of ideology between Magneto and Professor X. I wouldn't be surprised to see Magneto staying with Scott and Professor X going off with Wolverine back to Westchester.
Now, Jason Aaron, who's writing this, is also writing Wolverine and the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a sense, this is issue -5 of Wolverine and the X-Men.
Yep. And Pacheco is staying on as the artist. I think he's going to be one of the two rotating artists on Uncanny,
so,
along with Greg Land.
So when I say it's, in a sense, issue -5 of the new X-Men title, it's issue 1 of the new X-Men title. There was a mini-series leading into this, which we mentioned, Prelude to Schism. Which,
it's why we sighed when we said Schism at the start of this review,
yeah.
Because what we're sighing about is not this book, which, as we'll come on to say in a minute, is actually pretty good. Prelude is the problem.
That was a particularly egregious exercise in gouging the fans.
Mm.
What it consists of is, it's supposed to be a Rashomon-type thing, and it consists of 4 issues of the X-Men standing around on Utopia discussing what they're going to do about some mysterious impending threat, probably the Celestials, to the extent that you can make anything out of the dialogue that's
mm-hmm.
there. In fact, each issue is mostly a different character doing flashbacks, which is, you know, supposed to be telling us something about their past. In fact, is really just an excuse to rehash material from Magneto Testament, Wolverine Origins, things of that sort. It's basically a clip book.
Is it one for each of the... Is it Wolverine, Professor X?
Yeah, there's
Magneto
one in each issue.
Okay.
Issue 1 is Professor X, 2 is Magneto, 3 is Cyclops, 4 is Wolverine.
I'd love it if they were the ones that they were stories we were hashing. Would have been like, you know, we're going to do Magneto Testament for Magneto, we're going to do Wolverine Origins for Wolverine, we're going to do the Cyclops miniseries that Brian K. Vaughan wrote.
The Cyclops one is basically Cyclops lamenting the loss of his mother for 20 pages.
Well, that's certainly unfair, fertile ground, which we've not seen tilled before with Cyclops.
So, yeah, I mean, it's basically 4 issues of utterly random flashback that tells you precisely nothing, with characters speaking about some incredible, dangerous threat that's coming. But we're now told by Jason Aaron and by Nick Lowe that, in fact, the incredibly dangerous threat that Prelude spends 4 issues building up to, A, is not in Schism, and B, apparently, is not in anything else either.
It's not important.
It's not important, you see. It's thematic.
Fighting against themes is what it is. I'd like to see if the story actually resolves somewhere else later on. It turned out it wasn't the Celestials. It was like Nanny and Orphan Maker were coming.
That'd be awesome.
And they're like, what can we do? What can we do about the tiny egg?
But on the bright side, Prelude to Schism was rubbish. The less it has to do with the actual Schism book, the better. What Schism is actually about is Kid Omega is brought back.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually brought back in a miniseries
quite some time ago.
Yeah,
Pack Phoenix things.
He's basically brought in as an anarchist who is causing trouble and stirring up anti-mutant sentiment again. It's actually been a while since we've had anti-mutant sentiment done in a really big way in the X-Books.
I think that's because they couldn't do it after M-Day. Because it's like, oh no, they fear us now that we're the size of a local football team's travelling support, you know.
Well, I mean, that's still a problem with this, to be honest. But, I mean, they're trying to do it here anyway, and, you know, whatever. There is a Children's Crusade, which looks like it's about to potentially undo the M-Day thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically this first issue. There's also a new villain who is a 12-year-old boy who is the new head of an arms dealership and is now going to be a supervillain.
He reminds me a little bit of Zeke Stain from Fraction's Iron Man.
But younger.
But similar in terms of ambition and murderous drive.
Yeah. It's a very Jason Aaron comic because this Cade Kilgore here is an incredibly campy Silver Age concept. And Aaron likes this sort of, you know, nonsense, this kind of intentionally ridiculous thing in his Wolverine stories, and now he's, you know, throwing utterly crazy, plainly ridiculous ideas into an X-Men story. I'm not quite sure that it fits the tone of the X-Men, but in many ways I'm quite glad to see him doing it anyway.
I think it fits the tone of the X-Men's villains when you look back and you see just who some of the X-Men's villains are.
Really?
It doesn't fit well. I mean, for instance, Mr. Sinister. Mr. Sinister is, firstly, a really stupid campy name for a supervillain. Secondly, is a preposterous design for a supervillain. And thirdly, is the most bizarre and convoluted set of motivations ever given to a supervillain.
That's true.
Well, the X-Men have had some dappy, really, really weird villains before.
That's true, but A, Sinister's very much of his time, and B, in fairness to Chris Claremont, the original idea was that he was a small child's idea of a supervillain.
Yeah, which again is a kind of bonkers off-the-wall idea, and if Aaron is doing a, you know, here's the new head of the Hellfire Club, he's a 12-year-old boy with
sure.
a gun.
Yeah, the X-Men generally don't do Silver Age camp, the obvious exception being Arcade and Mojo.
Yeah.
And Cade is... therefore, something the X-Men don't have, really, in their rogues gallery. And that's a good thing.
As well, I don't think either of them were created for the X-Men, were they?
Arcade was created by Chris Claremont and Marvel Team-Up and imported,
yeah.
And Mojo was created
from
for the Longshot
Mini.
But he was reinvented so drastically for the X-Men, mm-hmm. which brought in the whole idea of him being a media satire, mm-hmm. That effectively he's, if not a Claremont creation, certainly a Claremont reinvention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when you look at some of the other villains that the X-Men have had, you get guys like, I mean, for instance, Cameron Hodge. Cameron Hodge is an angry head on some wires.
Oh, I liked that.
You know, you can have very, very silly villains in the X-Men, and I think that they can work with them, partly because the X-Men are a team where, you know, none of the characters, it's not like they've got thematically linked powers or anything like that. You know, it's not like the Fantastic Four where you can ascribe the elements to them or anything. They've each got fairly random powers. So anything could really happen in the X-Men when it comes to, you know, what power is somebody going to manifest. Obviously that doesn't apply to this villain who doesn't appear to have any powers, but certainly X-Men's always been the kind of slightly off the wall side of the Marvel Universe, or certainly should be.
But there's still a degree of camp here you don't normally get in the X-Men, but again, that's maybe not a bad thing. Maybe that's why he fills a gap in the book.
Mm. The story, as such as in this first issue, is about Wolverine and Cyclops going to... is it to the UN they've gone to?
It's described as some sort of arms control conference.
Okay. It certainly appears to be... the big UN chamber in Switzerland. It looks like, because yeah, I went and toured this when I was on holiday there, and it looks very much like the inside of the Geneva branch of the UN.
They do say it's Switzerland.
Mm. Oh, that would be it then, they're definitely in the UN. And Cyclops is giving a speech about the Sentinels, which is now such old and dilapidated technology that the basic version of it has gotten around, and people have been working on them themselves, and now everybody's got their own Sentinels. Now, somebody asked me on Twitter if this was a new thing, basically comparing Sentinels to black market ICBMs, and I had thought that it was, but then someone on our blog pointed out that it actually is an idea which has been used before in the Mystique's solo series.
Oh, the Sean McKeever thing.
Yeah, I think it was Brian Vaughn's run, the initial 12 issues, where...
It was people selling
Sentinels from Russia to Cuba or something like that.
Yeah, I quite like the idea of Sentinels being sold around the globe. There's something quite nice about the idea that in the Marvel Universe, the international arms trade consists of the USA selling off second-hand Kirby tech to Iran. And that,
but not as good. It's all kind of knockoff stuff. The penultimate nullifier and things.
Yeah,
like that.
The government of Iran is still sitting around using with all this stuff from 1960s Kirby stories. So,
guys in North Korea, Kim Jong Il is like, we have discovered the secret of cobalt.
Because the Sentinels who appear in this first issue are the Sentinels from the very first story in X-Men 14 or
yes.
so, back in 1965,
yeah.
And they're coloured accordingly, and they're the right size. They're the rubbish early Sentinels, mm-hmm. which is why they get taken apart in two pages.
Yep.
I like that idea.
Lovely double page spread, by the way.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really nice idea. That when the Marvel Universe that we're reading has moved on beyond a certain concept, it's maybe still eking out a living somewhere in a different part of the globe.
Yes, that's basically just what we do with the official handbook every time round, isn't it? It's like, well, what about the stupid thing that hasn't been mentioned for a long time? Well, it's probably out there somewhere.
It's probably in Iran.
Yeah. Apart from Cyclops and Wolverine, though, the main players in this series seem to be, so far at least, Emma, because Emma is always a main player in the X-Men at the moment, and Magneto, which makes me wonder why in... I know this is going to sound like I'm barking up this same stupid tree again, but why in Prelude to Schism it wasn't in some way involving Emma? The other major characters, the Gen Hope kids... who really do get an awful lot of screen time in this. Gen Hope does seem from the solicits like it's going to be tying into Schism quite heavily, which you would expect given that Gillen is writing Gen Hope and writing Uncanny X-Men.
Well, I think any book that's set on Utopia has to tie into Schism in some way, because by definition anything that alters the status quo of the X-Men sitting around on Utopia is going to alter the status quo of all the other books to set there. New Mutants and Generation Hope have no choice but to tie into this, even if only to acknowledge the change.
Yeah,
but the subsidiary teams are going to have to do something about either striking out on their own or choosing sides.
Yeah.
It's a story you've got to do.
Mm. But in this book, it's, you know, it's Hope and ID and people like that. It's not Danny and Sam that are playing part in this first issue, at least.
It is odd that Xavier's not used in this at all. I think... Mike Carey has mentioned that the cast of X-Men Legacies basically sit out this entire crossover because they're off-world. I don't know whether Xavier's still in that.
Because the pages for X-Men Schism issue 2 feature Rogue very prominently.
That is interesting.
At the back of the book here.
That is interesting.
So they're not that much off-panel. But anyway, this first issue... Well, it sets up the basic relationship that you got between Scott and Logan, and it sets up Cade Kilgore as the primary villain for the series. Doesn't actually feature what one might call a schism,
or that much of a threat, really.
I mean, it introduces
a villain, but you know, there's no actual concrete threat beyond, there's a lot of anti-mutant sentiment around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is fine in terms of, you know, if you want to bring that back to the fore, that's great and all. But in terms of a concrete threat, we don't really get that. But it's a fun read. I like the tone of it. I think it's got a more upbeat feel to it. That even though it's going for the everyone hates the X-Men angle, got a more upbeat feel to it, which is something that's actually quite a good thing for the X-Books.
Yes, a lot of the X-Books over the past, well, since M-Day really, have had this kind of horrible headachey feeling to them of nobody in these books is having any fun. No one's very nice. Like, Cyclops in this comic is actually someone who you can see why you would want him to be the leader of your superhero team, whereas Cyclops in a lot of comics over the past few years has been very... well, kind of unlikable, really. Cyclops has always been uptight, but, you know, you wouldn't expect people to be encountering Cyclops and coming away thinking this guy is an absolute idiot, total jerk.
Yeah, I think they kind of have missed the mark in the way they've been writing Cyclops the last few years. I mean, I get that they're building to the idea of, is he compromising his ideals? Is he doing things that the rest of the team will eventually turn on him for? They haven't entirely all managed to get the other side of the character, which, as you say, is why would people want to follow him in the first place?
Yeah, and I don't know what the schism can really be about. I mean, it's not like the schism is going to be about the fact that he set up X-Force, for example, because, well... The person on the other side of the schism is the guy who was the leader of X-Force and is now the leader of Super Secret X-Force.
Which Cyclops doesn't know about.
Exactly. So, you know, what the ideological ground for the schism is actually going to be, I don't know. But Aaron has got a really good handle on making Cyclops a likeable character, even though you can tell he is still the same uptight Cyclops. And Aaron's Wolverine is just great. Like, I think he's got a brilliant handle on Wolverine. You can see that in his own title as well.
Oh, he writes the character really well. There's no doubt about that.
Mm. On the art side of things, Pacheco is doing some beautiful work here. Really, really gorgeous. A lot of it doesn't even look like sort of old style Carlos Pacheco-y stuff. A lot of it actually gives me the kind of impression of John Cassaday's work.
Oh, that's a very good point. You're right. That Pacheco's work used to be sort of quite similar to, say, Salvador Larroca's. There's a very great similarity in style
the
there.
The way that Salva worked for a while, definitely.
And you're right. There's a shift here to at least... there are bits of this that look like they would be more at home in a John Cassaday comic.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I've seen a Carlos Pacheco comic, to be fair. I don't know whether his style's been changing generally over the last few...
The point one issue of Uncanny. That looks more like his older style of thing.
Who's inking this? Cam Smith.
He's a long-time workhorse inker.
I think he's inked Pacheco before, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, back way, way, way back. I think he may even have inked some of Pacheco's very, very first stuff. I would not be surprised to go back and find out that he had inked Dark Guard, which was Pacheco's first art assignment for Marvel.
Did Cam Smith not do... I mean, Cam Smith's been around for ages. Did he not do things like Light and Darkness War?
Cam Smith's been around doing comics for, I think, about 30 or 40...
Yeah.
Well, not 40, maybe not, but about 30 years. But I think he may have inked Pacheco on Dark Guard. It's weird when you look back at those Marvel UK books and you think these are the places where these guys got their starts. Carlos Pacheco and Salvador Larroca both started off there. Before Pacheco moved on to, I think the next thing was a Bishop limited series was the second thing he did, or something like that.
Yeah.
He kind of kicked around on some very strange sort of side assignments before he got given anything very major to work on. Interesting thing we learn in this comic is that Ahmadinejad's mutant power is an extra finger.
And also in the Marvel Universe, he's slightly more bald.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And clearly a different person entirely.
And definitely not Ahmadinejad. No.
Definitely not.
As X-Men stories go, though, this is a double-sized issue. And fills the story out quite nicely. It's almost the kind of thing you would expect to see in an X-Men annual if it was going to be starting off the crossover, you know. It works for the length of the story that it is. It works to set up the villain and to re-establish the relationship between Wolverine and Cyclops. And it really does show that the relationship between Wolverine and Cyclops is the core of this series. And on all those fronts, I think this really works. This is one of the best X-Men comics I've read for a while.
One book of Jason Aaron doing this and another of Kieran Gillen on Uncanny.
Yeah, it's pretty promising, isn't it?
This is pretty promising.
Yeah, I think this could be the start of something pretty great for the X-Books. Here's hoping, anyway. Moving on now from X-Men Schism to our last book, which is the four-issue miniseries The Red Wing from Image, which is Jonathan Hickman and Nick Pitara.
This is a science fiction book, I guess. It's the first creator-owned thing Jonathan Hickman's done in a while. I think the first creator-owned thing he's done since he broke through at Marvel.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah. He's got a new thing solicited from Image this month as well. I think it's a sort of a 72-page thing, which is designed to be the first of a number of one-shots, which will have several months of shelf life each. But, he obviously is getting back to flexing a creator-owned muscle again, which he's not really been able to do while he's been doing so much Marvel stuff.
This is a four-issue mini, which priced at $3.50, so splitting the difference there.
Mm.
And it's a sci-fi thing. It's basically, fighter pilots, but fighting through time.
Through time and with time. It's like if we created a time machine, what would we do with it? Would we use it to forward science and mankind's knowledge of the universe and everything? No, we would use it to go to war with each other, and they have.
Although there's never actually any explanation of who they're at war with.
No.
They're just at war. It could be alien invaders, it could be other people.
It doesn't
ultimately matter.
Yeah, I mean, we do get to see baddies that they're fighting, but we don't get to see whether they're aliens or whether they are things which have been set up by another nation in the world. I mean, there are sort of big mecha things with tentacles and odd squiddy bulbous things which are also mechanical.
So in the opening scene, you've got these three pilots and their time fighters, or whatever they're going to be called. Mm. It does get given a name later on, doesn't it? It's called Attack Fighter. So you've got these three pilots in their TAC fighters in the past doing fighty type stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of them is killed and the other two the other two go missing at least.
Yeah.
And then in the future, you've got their descendants joining the Air Force and hoping they might still be alive or maybe wanting to follow in their footsteps. And of course, since this is a time travel story, there's no good reason why the two generations can't meet at some point later on, which is presumably where this is going.
It does seem to be. I mean, there is one guy whose father, well, both of the main characters' fathers seem to have been lost in this war, but one of them, we get occasional flashbacks to where he gets stranded at some other point in time.
But one of the fathers,
a couple of months.
Yeah, the other father is presumably killed. Because
yeah, there's a very graphic page of it happening.
With some very nice frame-by-frame breakdown, actually. It's a really nice page.
Mm-hmm. And because it's pilots 1, 2 and 3, and they are helpfully labelled on their helmets and on their shoulder pads. But pilot 2 dies. Pilot 1 is the father of one of the main characters. And pilot 3 is this woman who we don't see again for the rest of this issue. But the technology of travelling through time is very dangerous, and you can be killed if you don't have the proper shielding on your ship. Mm. And it's all about, oh, my dad got lost because if the plane goes down, then technically they might be shielded, but almost always the actual impact of the crash or the injury damages the shielding to the extent that people just die.
There's a very slim chance of surviving if you crash. That's basically it. And obviously, this being a story, if there's a very slim chance of surviving, then you're going to survive.
Yes.
I have to say that reading this, I kind of got the impression that this was a story which was more interested in setting out its time travel premise than really setting up the characters in a very interesting way. I kind of got the feeling that, you know, that Jonathan Hickman has a nice idea about non-linear time that he thinks makes an interesting structural conceit. Mm-hmm. And he's got some sort of off-the-shelf characters he's plugged into that plot, but who he hasn't really developed in any particularly interesting way. Now, whether that's because this first issue, by its nature, has to be really exposition-heavy in order to set out the idea, or whether it's just because this really is a story that's about its sci-fi concept rather than about its characters, I'm not totally sure. Mm-hmm. But what it certainly doesn't do is make me that interested in the characters.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite of All Nighter, really. Whereas All Nighter was all about the characters and not really about the plot, this is all about the plot and not really about the characters. I expect that in the next few issues, now that we've established the setup of who these characters are and shown where they all are on the board, we will get a little bit more of the actual personalities of the characters, because it will be very difficult to drive this story forward if we don't. But you're right in saying that, as matters stand, none of the main characters are particularly well fleshed out. What I like is the look of this book in particular. Nick Patara is an artist who I've never seen anything by him before. I'd never heard of him until picking up this book. But he's got a great, great style. It's very Frank Quitely. It's also got a little bit of like Mobius in there as well, and a little bit of Ladron.
I'm not sure I'd say it's very Frank Quitely, but I can see that that's an influence that's in there.
Super Quitely.
But yeah, there's certainly a Mobius Quitely sort of vibe to it. What I like about it in terms of the design sense is these rather blocky, asymmetrical aircraft that he's designed, which just look kind of odd, but also have a nice sort of clunky and retro look to them.
They're like the kinds of things that got designed for movies and toy lines in the 70s. You know, when everything was kind of Japanese-influenced, you know? Like you were seeing things coming across that were influenced by Robotech and so on in the 80s.
You can absolutely see these coming out of a box.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like
there's a slot on the underside for the batteries.
Yeah, and the design of it is really, really good. It's the kind of thing where you'd almost expect to see it filmed. Like, you wouldn't be surprised to see a Red Wing movie in 5 years' time. And I think, certainly, it seems to be paced as almost like a movie is paced, where you get your pre-credit sequence, and then you get a fairly... I don't want to say space-wasting, because it's definitely... marking out the introductory part of the comic very cleanly from the rest of the comic. But it's quite striking, and it really does stop you from, you know, it stops the end of, start that again, it's quite striking, and it really does mark where one part of the story finishes, gives you a bit of a sorbet almost, and then where the next part of the story starts. I think that works really well. It is 4 pages out of the issue though.
Yeah, and in the middle we've got this sequence of these two sons of the pilots essentially explaining the plot to one another, and then attending a lecture where somebody explains the plot to them some more. And by my count, you've got one, two. I'll skip that. I'll grant that one because it's been an establishing shot. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of expository dialogue.
Yeah.
In a block.
Yeah.
Broken up only by an establishing shot of the planet Earth with a ring around it.
Mm-hmm.
That's an awful lot of exposition.
Yeah, particularly when you have to have the characters say things to each other like, both of their fighters were destroyed. We know that. It's like, you're actually pointing out that your characters know what this plot is.
Hey, we've been best friends our entire lives.
In case you weren't aware... I wonder if that ever actually happens in real life, people just exposit at each other. Like, if we were to go and sit in the pub on a Tuesday night and do the pub quiz, and, you know, you turned up and would just be like, ah, here we are at the pub, you know, where we have the pub quiz. I'm going to go and get some of these beers. They often have a selection of guest ales, which we like to try from time to time. Would you like a guest ale?
Maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe in, I don't know, Germany, everyone talks like that. If only I could speak German. I could listen to the exposition.
They just walk around expositing each other all day, every day.
Yeah.
It's why they have to be so efficient in the running of the country.
Yeah.
Never get anything done.
There are some nice ideas here. There's some quite nice art. Doesn't really take off as a story.
As a story, no. As the premise for the next 3 issues, yes, that is all established. And by the end of this first issue, we certainly are ready for the rest of the plot to happen.
It's a decent premise in need of some characters.
Yeah, which again is in contrast to All-Nighter, which is decent characters in need of a premise. Both of these books, the other thing they have in common is that they've got very, very great artwork on them. Like, really properly brilliant artwork.
Yep.
Actually, all three of these books are like this time around, aren't they? You know, the story doesn't really get started, and they've all got fantastic artwork.
Maybe
we've accidentally chosen... This group of comics we've put together is not linked in terms of story, Paul. It's a thematic link.
It's a thematic link. Well, we could call them a mini-series.
Anyway, that's the Red Wing. That's the comics for this time around as well. And we're just going to move on now to the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, as always. And we're looking back at a Golden Age character again this time around, a character that made his appearance, possibly his only appearance, I didn't actually go and check this, in Red Raven Comics, issue 1, back in 1940.
Well, there only was one issue of Red Raven Comics.
Yeah,
so
but he might have turned up in others.
They might have moved him somewhere, too.
Certainly the description of stuff that he did sounds like either he was in a bunch of different stories or he had an insanely hectic first appearance. This is a guy called...
It's the Golden Age.
It is the Golden Age. See, he sounds like a Fletcher Hanks character, but he's a Jack Kirby character, apparently, by the little inset in this artwork. It's a guy called Comet Pierce.
Comet Pierce.
Which is a good name. I wonder if his, you know, parents decided that that would be a lovely name to call him. It's like, well, name him after your Uncle Comet. And he's like, oh, I don't want to call him after Uncle Comet. He's such a pain. He always comes around here and, like, slags off our house and stuff. And they're like, no, no, you know that your mum and dad would be really annoyed if you don't name him after Uncle Comet. He's like, boom, it's a family name, I guess.
Comet Pierce, attorneys at law. John Pierce and Majestic Comet.
I think it'd be better if it was just, like, you know, John Pierce, Steve Comet. Anyway, so he was a space racer. who, apparently in the tradition of the Roman charioteer Caius Marcus and dirt track racer Cyclone Smith of 1940.
Because in the future they'll remember dirt track racer Cyclone Smith from 1940.
He's the most daring rocket racer of 2150.
So basically he's from Wipeout.
Pretty much, although I think it's actual rockets. I think they went through space.
Okay.
He's described in terms of his abilities and accessories as having a ship which, unlike his competitors, can travel to sub-light speeds prior to going to supraluminal speeds, which makes...
No, I think it says what was unlike its competitors was the fact that it was designed to look like a 20th century aeroplane.
Oh, it was because
otherwise it would be a bit of a rubbish race.
Well, the thing is, the way it's phrased here is his personal rocket, designed with aerodynamic wings like an early 20th century airplane, brackets, unlike his competitors' brackets, can travel to sublight speeds prior to solar engine conversion. You could really... Well, you need a comma in there somewhere.
It'd be a rubbish race if he just had a faster rocket than everyone else.
Well, he just,
that'd be a terrible story if all it was, well, once again, I've got the fastest rocket. That was simple. Granted, Bernie Eccleston has managed to build an entire industry off a sport built on a very similar floor. But no, I think the idea is that he uniquely is inexplicably flying a space Spitfire.
Well, he apparently...
Which is great.
Well, he apparently managed to take part in a race where he, despite having been marooned by the treacherous competitor that was his arch nemesis, he managed to repair his craft, rejoin the race, speed far ahead of the other competitors, and get to Earth weeks before the other people who were taking part in the race. So it's entirely possible that he was literally the only guy who had a faster-than-light ship in this entire race. And you can see why they would, in that case, have actually sabotaged his ship, frankly.
It's the America's Cup, isn't it? It's with space. Actually, what this is the Wacky Races.
Well, yeah, we did the Wacky Races last time with the old Nightflyer, though, didn't we? So he's possibly another candidate for that, but his actual story presents some other possibilities for him. During this race, the Jupiter Run race, the baddie, Jort, sabotaged Pierce's rocket and marooned him on an asteroid, where Pierce was saved from a space serpent by Queen Lorena of Martian Zoranthus and her diminutive Plutonian companion, Murphy.
Murphy?
Murphy, Irish Plutonians, obviously.
I really hope that was a space stereotype. diminutive, it'll have been a leprechaun. It'll be an offensive space leprechaun.
He woke up to find Lorena in love with him, as you do, and demanded...
He's called Comet Pierce. The woman's got taste.
He demanded to know who she was, and in response, she left a solar engine for his rocket. Now, you just don't get that in romance stories nowadays, do you? It's like, but I must know your name. And she drops a jet turbine on him.
I woke up in the morning, and she was gone, leaving only a turbine.
You'd think I would have woken up at the part where she had to take one of the walls out of the building in order to do it, but no. No, I was really, really drunk. So he punched Jort with a tough left hook once Jort arrived at Earth and went to find Lorena. Like who he waited for weeks. He returned to Earth weeks before Jort, and then when Jort got there... He punched him and then went to find the girl. Don't take these weeks that you've got spare, these weeks you've got in hand to go and find the girl who's fallen in love with you and given you this jet turbine thing. No, wait for the guy to turn up who nobbled your vehicle, smack him in the chops once, then go and find her.
It seems to me that Comet Pierce has his priorities just about right. A man doesn't go straight off in search of a woman until he's punched another man in the face first. That's how it was in the 40s, especially in New York.
In space. So he goes to Mars, meets a chieftain there who he has to converse with in sign language, and then goes to Callisto.
That must have worked on the page.
Goes to Callisto, saves Murphy from a devil tree, and then finds Lorena on an icy moon of Saturn and offers to help her fight Golak, the dictator who had deposed her.
At which point the series is cancelled.
Yeah, after
which
issue one.
Means there's plenty of material there for a modern writer to pick up on Comet Pierce.
Plenty of material there for an Essentials volume, I think. This is about 15 stories there in one issue of Red Raven Comics.
I mean, frankly, well, I think he must have been transferred into some other features in order for that to to have done that much. Yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, even by Silver Age standards, you'd have got about a year out of that.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to see, though, is what happens next. You know, you've got a guy who is able to zip around within the solar system quite handily in his ship, but is quite content that on Saturn there would be this dictator who is ruling over people. If there are races backwards and forwards through the solar system, they presumably all know that this is going on in Saturn and choose instead to turn a blind eye to it in favour of this bread and circuses thing that's going on with these races. Now, I don't know whether this is something that even possibly is set up by Golak, the dictator of Saturn. You know, he's the one that funds these races.
Well, he already knows Garu sign language, so presumably he does know that there are Martians out there. It's just that they don't join in these races.
Yeah, well, it seems to be people go to and from Earth as part of this thing. You know, there are people on Pluto, and there are people on Earth, and there are people on Jupiter, and, you know, he went round Mercury and Venus as well, so he's got all the stamps on his space passport. But I'm just wondering whether, you know, the space races are set up as something to distract the population of the solar system from the fact that they're these terrible humanitarian, or whatever they would be called, aeons from Saturn, breaches of their Saturnian rights happening. And Comet Pierce is not just a participant in these races, he's a star of these races. Comet Pierce is basically the story of the man who is the idol of the Reich, who wakes up and discovers that actually Hitler may be funding his Formula One team or whatever, but, you know, he doesn't want to be his mate anymore.
That's the Vertigo take. There is no character incapable of being upgraded for Vertigo. Listen, what I like about Comet Pierce is this would make such a great feature for the Eagle.
Oh, it would be
brilliant. Just as it is.
Just played straight.
Comet Pierce is a man from the future who races in space rallies and goes to alien worlds where he encounters trouble but escapes using his skills as a space rally driver.
Yep.
That's an the Eagle would have got years out of that.
Yeah,
it
it's actually
fantastic.
Quite a 2000 AD concept as well. Yeah.
I mean, in fairness, this being a throwaway Golden Age comic, this had legs. This could have worked.
Yeah, what I want to see is a story where, you know, the characters from the 2099 universe, which did continue on in that last Manifest Destiny, was the last issue of that was published after the fact. And the characters were, you know, 100 years into the future beyond that by the end of it. So this stuff was all going on at that time. So what happens when Spider-Man 2099 turns up and finds that
it'll be quite
the evil Golak has been overthrown? And what instead is happening is that Saturn is now an entire civilization based around NASCAR.
Well, if it's NASCAR, they just go round and round in orbit.
Anyway, so Comet Pierce, plenty to do with him. I honestly think that there's a lot you can get out of this character.
I genuinely do. You could do a mini-series with this and it would work. Comet Pierce.
Call us,
NASCAR
Marvel.
Driver of the future.
Call us. Anyway, that's the official handbook of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It's the end of the podcast as well. We will, as almost always, be back in a fortnight's time. But until then, you can catch up with us on the blog, which is housetoastonish.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm Iv Destroyed and Alice House to Astonish.
We've got our email address, is housetoastonish@gmail.com. And we've got our Facebook fan page, where you can just go to Facebook, search for House to Astonish, and it shall magically appear.
We'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
Bye.
Bye.